This episode of the podcast is brought to you by my company, Horns of Odin. Now, Horns of Odin is a family-run business, and we sell Norse-inspired products. Particularly, we specialise in handmade, handcrafted drinking horns, which I made myself. But alongside that, we have a huge clothing collection. We sell a bunch of different meads. We've got beers and ales. We've got handmade jewellery, books, artwork. So if you like the sound of any of that, pop over to the website. It's www.hornsofodin.com. If you like anything, pop it in the cart. Use the code HORNS10 at checkout and you're going to get 10% off your entire order. Now that's HORNS10. It's going to get you 10% off your entire order. It's just a little thank you from us for listening to the podcast. The podcast is also brought to you by our website, NordicMythologyPodcast.com. Some of you have already seen that we've got a bunch of different merch on there. We've got some t-shirt designs. Now we've just added a brand new limited edition t-shirt. So there's only going to be 100 of these printed. After that, we're never going to print them again. So just pick one up whilst you can. So the design has been done by last week's guest, Jakob, aka Raven from the North, who was on last week's episode. It's a one-off design. Just pop over to the website, have a look. It's Odin and his two ravens. It's a really beautiful t-shirt. I'm definitely going to get one. I think we've sold probably about 25% of them already. So just pop over to NordicMythologyPodcast.com and have a look and see what you think. Right, let's jump into the show. Hello and welcome to the Nordic Mythology Podcast. I'm Daniel Farron, co-owner of the company Horns of Odin, and I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Matthias Nordvik.
Hello. All right, so we are joined by Kais Stitkevich, who is kind of an expert on like Viking martial arts, if there is such a thing. That's what we're going to find out. Kais is at the University of Cardiff in Wales, where he's doing his PhD thesis, which we just found out was titled Grappling with the Sagas, Embodied Knowledge and Reconstructing Martial Arts. So welcome to the show, Kais.
Pleasure to be here. I mean that.
Before we jump into the episode, I just want to throw maybe a little disclaimer out there that we might upset a few people with this episode, but it's never intentional. It's, you know, we want to bring the facts to all these different topics. And, you know, Gleamer is one of those that's out there. People see it, and I feel like there's a lot of misinformation to it. But I also think a lot of people might take it to heart if we don't necessarily agree with everything. And just if anybody does get upset, maybe look at yourself and why you're upset at us, speaking the facts about things. Maybe look at yourself before you call us names online.
I don't want to predict where the conversation is going to go, but I think we all have our suspicions. So I'll also give the disclaimer. It's coming from a place of love and respect. I don't have a dog in the fight. I just really love the sport. I love the culture. I love the techniques, and I researched it. So, you know, and came to some conclusions.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's what we always try to be on this show, is we try to be as kind of middle road and just factual based as possible. Some people don't always like it, but you know, hopefully that's why people listen, because they get the truth and not just what they want to hear.
Well, the thing is that nowadays, right, it's kind of a radical position when you go with like knowledge instead of like just taking like in side A or side B and then rolling with it. So I mean, and that's where we're at. We've been here before, so to speak, with other topics. We've been like, yeah, we're looking at the knowledge of all of this. We're looking at the facts behind them, and we're not going to pander to you know, a group that's saying A or saying B, and you know, shouting at each other. We're going to be in the radical position of let's have a conversation about it.
The radical rational position.
Exactly.
That's it. So when we're talking about combat, are we speaking about unarmed combat? I guess it's grappling. It's I guess it's not necessarily, would it be more of a
something done, I guess, in a friendly, competitive environment rather than an actual fight to the death.
So are we talking Glima specifically now?
I think just in general of where we're going to go with the episode. I assumed it would be more of like a competitive, friendly-esque, but I guess if you have stuff that leans more towards the actual in-war battle grappling, we can go there as well.
I got it all. Whichever way you want to go, I got it all.
No, that perfect. That makes me happy. Yeah, and we spoke a little bit before the show, and I was very happy to find out that you actually train martial arts. You know, you're coming from this from not only a scholarly standpoint, but somebody who has practiced martial arts and understands what works, what doesn't work. Because I think it's so easy to watch videos online sometimes, especially not just picking a gleam. I think in all kind of what I would call maybe ceremonial martial arts, it's easy for people to look at them and watch videos and think, oh, well, that would work. That's pretty. That, you know, that's something that would actually work in a fight. When in reality, it's usually the things that look ugly are the ones that work, and they're not necessarily the things that look good on video. So I was really excited to know that you've trained jiu-jitsu, you've trained Muay Thai, you know what works, what doesn't work. So you're coming at it from a really good angle, in my opinion, rather than just a scholarly side of somebody who doesn't necessarily know what it feels like to somebody to try and kill you.
Yeah, so academically, I've been interested in this topic. I was a history major way back in the day, undergraduate. I went to University of Iceland or Háskóli Íslands and did a master's there. And my thesis, over the last maybe 20 years, I read a lot of sagas. And when you read the sagas, there's lots of violence. And if you like fighting and violence, they're like a fairy tale. You know, they're just so much fun. And then when you've also been grappling your entire adult life, well, even beyond, I mean, since a kid, I've been wrestling at least. So I realized there's lots of fighting and that's cool, but damn, there's a lot of wrestling in the sagas. And you don't read, I mean, can you think of any other historical text from any culture where you bump into wrestling that frequently and that prominently? I can't, and I'm fairly well-versed in this area, so... It exists, it's ubiquitous, but it's rarely celebrated that much. So for me, and this would be like maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I first started being like, you know what, I'm going to start putting sticky notes on all the wrestling techniques I like just for fun. Well, you know, way before a thesis was in mind. And so it started growing, and I realized, well, there's hundreds of mentions, hundreds of references, and lots of explicit scenes. And even even saga heroes who are wrestlers or famous for their wrestling. So it was very clear that this was a big cultural aspect of something I really liked, which was saga literature and medieval history. And the other half of the equation is I grew up, I wrestled, I played rugby, I got into jiu-jitsu, I got into MMA, I did amateur cage fights. I still compete in no-gi and submission and BJJ tournaments, not so much during COVID, but pretty much all the time. And so my hobby, my personal life, has been grappling with sweaty human bodies. It's basically second nature to me now. And that's where a big part of my thesis argument comes in, kind of looking back at the sagas and actually identifying this technique is probably this, and let me test it out and test out what options we have, you know, and how the human body works and if this is physically possible or not, and terminology they use and things like that. And I started tinkering around and realizing, yeah, a lot of saga scholarship looked at grappling from the sagas and they thought, well, Vikings, what we know about how they fought is in the sagas. And they thought it was a lot like the war and the we'll call it the martial combat, which is a guy has a sword or an axe or a spear and he cuts down like 500 dudes in a sea of blood. And I love it. And they all talk smack as they're dying, which is wonderful.
Sometimes for a really long time, even.
Yeah, exactly. Sometimes impressively so. Or they even get their leg gets cut off, they grab a tree stump and use that to keep fighting.
I was just thinking about that one. Is that Gunnlaug?
Yeah.
I can just think of the Black Knight from Monty Python.
Yeah, now. Exactly.
Yeah, it's kind of like that, man.
Tis but a scratch.
Tis a flesh wound. So with scholarship looked at the wrestling like that, because some of it is like he picked them up and slammed them and his head exploded. Or, you know, the wrestling seems legit, but it's against a giant or a troll. So it didn't get any really serious attention. So I started giving it some serious attention and pretty quickly realized, wow, these are real moves, real techniques. I've used a lot of them and you can see them in other cultures. And one of the most important and impressive and interesting things about the sagas is the detail in which these moves are described are often a sentence or a paragraph even. And they even use specific terminology in Old Norse, of course, that does not translate well, which is a whole nother problem I ran into. Got to go to the original source language, because this shouldn't surprise you guys, but most 19th century and 20th century Old Norse scholars, not the toughest guys, you know, no offense. not pugilists, not grapplers, but eggheads.
Hey, I'm going to have to like kick one thing in here, and that is actually go back 100 years before that, and then you see like some of these scholars fighting out duels. I think it was Torfeus. He like killed a dude in a bar fight and stuff like that. So like, yeah, that's the 19th century, but the scholars before that, they were awesome.
I think people in general before that were tough as nails, you know?
Yeah, you're probably right.
But at any rate, so bridging the gap between, we'll say, academia and Old Norse studies and grappling or physical combat, martial arts, that's a big part of what my thesis is doing and my argument. But as it's in the title, and I think one of the most important points that Daniel was mentioning is embodied knowledge. That's another facet that you don't see much in academia, because the two worlds are so separate. Athletes and academics are generally not commingling that much. But with embodied knowledge, you can really go far in terms of analyzing physical acts. And if you think, and to explain to any listener or viewer that's not familiar, embodied knowledge is like the inherent knowledge you get from practicing something physically over and over so that your body becomes familiar with it, like riding a bike. You can explain to someone a million times how to ride a bike or blow glass or any skilled technique, physical technique, and they're going to get on a bike and they're going to eat shit immediately because it doesn't click. The body doesn't academically understand what it just read. It's not math. So with wrestling, it's the core. One of the most fundamental embodied knowledges we have is how does our body interact with another body? And this comes from animals and primates and survival. How do I not get beaten up by this caveman? Or if I'm a primate, how do I defend myself or my harem from this other primate invading my space? And it's advanced over the years, but we have swords, we have armor, guns, bows, and arrows. Technology skyrocketed, but grappling has really pretty much stayed the same. And you can look back in the Greeks, of course, were big wrestlers, and they described a lot of it in their literature, not as much in their fiction as much as just historical. They had competitions and they loved fighting and pancration and wrestling and greased dudes, everything. and even 1500 years before that, you see in ancient Egypt, you have wall murals in burial tombs that have the exact same tricks, trips, and throws that are described 1,000 years later, that are described 3,000 years later. And those Egyptians, they weren't the first to do it either. So it's pretty fundamental.
So what we're dealing with is basically a phenomenological side to the aspect of wrestling, like, because the human physical form is this, what you're seeing right here, basically there hasn't been much change, or there hasn't been much need for innovation, or how would you express that?
There's a great book by a guy named Ben Spatz, smart guy. He's into dance and theater, but the guy nailed it on really digging into embodied knowledge. His book is called What a Body Can Do. And it's about theater and dance, but I love it. If you like martial arts, it's completely compatible. And the term he uses is substrate, meaning like the foundational bedrock. Our bodies now are just like they were for all intents and purposes 1,000 years ago, 3,000, 5,000. Whereas armor, or, you know, rifles or bows and arrows or swords, everything else has changed drastically. And how can we make sure it was like they were doing it? But wrestling has pretty much stayed the fundamentally unchanged for millennia upon millennia. I'm actually very glad you brought that up, because I'm not arguing that we can just read about any martial art and figure out how they did it. Really, I'm specifically arguing that we can do it with wrestling and other, I use wrestling as in the broadest sense, grappling. We can do it with grappling because there are so few variables in the equation. My body, your body, flat surface, physics, and, you know, kinesiology, how a joint can bend. And once you, and anyone who wrestles nowadays or does judo or any kind of grappling, and especially MMA, which integrates pretty much whatever works best, is what we do. Once you start grappling, resisting opponents, I don't know if you're mentioning this, Dan, before the podcast, but the actual techniques that work are very rarely flashy. They're mm-hmm. flashy if you're miles better than your opponent and you can have fun with them. If it's danger or life and death, it's sloppy and it's practical. And so those techniques, we see them in the sagas, we see them before the sagas, and we see them and use them since the sagas, which leads a nice segue to Glima, which is Glima a sport that's uniquely Scandinavian or Icelandic even? Right now, currently, sport Glima, I would agree that it is. But was what they were doing 800, 1,000 years ago? And what was that uniquely Scandinavian? It was kind of just folk wrestling, and the techniques and moves are found in every form of folk wrestling and more and less codified versions of grappling. And as logic would dictate, how did the Vikings fight? Well, they fought practically, just like everyone who ever fights for their life. You do what's practical. You're not worried about showing off usually, unless it's for sport, which is where sport Glima came from. In real life, you do a hip throw and you slam them into the ground as hard and as fast as you can to get it over with quickly. There's very little decoration. So
yeah, I think it's not pretty when it's a fight for their life as well. I think eye poking, biting, gouging,
yeah,
testicle grabbing. I think anything goes, because at the end of the day, it's you know, it's whoever wins it. But when it comes to being a sport, it's very much a different thing. It's, you know, it's got rules to protect each other, I think.
Yeah, and obviously common sense again. Eye gouging, kneeing in the balls, and biting the throats, which you see some throat biting in the sagas, actually, usually against a troll or a berserker, but there is throat biting. Those aren't skills or techniques that you would codify and call Viking or Icelandic, you know? Those are just survival at its most fundamental.
Mm-hmm. So
for sure.
Have you found any tendency to maybe like associate certain like styles or certain moves with a particular type of character as opposed to another kind of figure? I mean, we both know, as people who are well-trained in reading sagas, that they use different stereotypes in the saga literature. Are there like certain ways of wrestling that are more associated with a berserker or a troll and that kind of stuff?
Okay, I got you. Yeah, interesting question. Because of the context in which each grappling match occurs is usually different, so it's hard to directly compare, because I don't think the saga authors had that question in mind when writing it. But looking at what we have, the evidence we have, first of all, the most violent and the nastiest moves, and the ones that break limbs and split skulls, and especially throat tearing and low blows, those are exclusively when the good guy hero, a protagonist, is fighting a bad guy, not even guy, a troll or a giant or something evil. Then they really take, you know, it almost, some of the moves become fantastical almost.
Mm.
But when it's a human against a human, especially a saga character, it's often clean and respectful, and they hold the one knee rule, where if a guy is downed, you win the point. There's no ground fighting. I don't know whether to return to this later or get to it now, but ground fighting is a whole nother area where I see a lot of people these days pretending and kind of projecting techniques like arm bars onto Viking survival techniques. I won't drop any names, but you kind of know who I'm alluding to. They did not do arm bars. There were no arm bars. There were no joint and submission locks. I mean, maybe they existed, but they just were never, ever, ever written about or spoken of. And we have no evidence of that. But I see like adverts, come join our Scandinavian brotherhood and we'll teach you how to fight like a Viking. And it shows these two kids doing a sloppy arm bar and like, red flag, red flag, red flag. But to finish your question, or to finish my answer, oftentimes the grappling is used as kind of a plot device, where the good guy will try to do techniques that are healthy, and the enemy will try to cheat or will be a poor sportsman, or we'll go for a dirty move and the crowd will disapprove of it, which is kind of a good way to put your finger on the pulse of how society viewed those kind of altercations. And not much has changed. Dirty shots are not, they might be effective, but the audience watching, they're not happy with that. They don't like the guy doing the dirty shots, and they don't want the good guy doing that stuff either. I don't know if that answered your question or danced around it, but...
Well, a little calm A, a little calm B. What about like scenarios where you have, because there are a couple that I can think of, at least, where you have two giants fighting, two giants wrestling. Are there any like particular descriptions of what they do and how they do it and so on? And also, how often are the genitals showing? Because that's something that I've run into a couple of times.
This is not my theory, but this is... not well established. I mean, how many people actually look into giants' genitals in saga literature? Not many, but of the few who have, there's a good answer, which is a lot of what we have are surviving manuscripts and texts that have gone through the ringer of Christian scribes translating and rewriting and copying. And they didn't like their nudity. They didn't like their profanity. Parts of Grettir's saga have been completely redacted, and we don't know what happened because it was dirty. And I mean, that's a bummer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But what we also know about religious fundamentalists is that they are extremely sexually repressed. So when they find an outlet, they go for it. And the only outlet they had back then was giant and troll women, you know, with hanging lips and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah, that's right.
And they describe that stuff in gruesome detail, probably not, you know, joking aside, probably because they're getting off on it.
Probably, yes. Yeah, yeah, no, it was exactly, there's a scene in Thorstein's saga Bæjarmands, where he is, he's like sailing northwards, and then he's somewhere, you know, north of Norway, and he sees two giants wrestling. I think it's a male and a female giant. And then like the saga goes into like a description of the female giant's genitals that are hanging out.
A solid paragraph. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like, what the hell's going on, guys? And also, it's very obvious the guy who wrote that did not know what female genitals look like.
or giant genitals just look different. You don't know.
Yeah. Oh, maybe, yeah.
So, you mentioned there male and a female giant wrestling. Do we know whether they practiced sort of mixed gender wrestling or combat?
From the sources, I mean, who knows? But from the sources, it was not. It's never mentioned. Mm-hmm. There's some physical conflicts between men and women in the sagas, but never grappling.
There is of course Thor, who has a reputation for beating women, and he there is the situation at Utgarda-Loki's. So that's like an example. Whether or not that's useful in any context, that's
in my defense question. I said saga, not mythology, so
that is true.
She's a woman, but she's got an ace up her sleeve, which is that she's also literally time. So
yes, exactly.
Is he really beating up a woman?
No, she only brings him to his knee, so I
yeah, true. So yeah, there's very, very little there's lots of men fighting female trolls, but there's literally no human or pseudo historical human versus male versus female human grappling. Rewinding about 2 minutes, one thing that comes to mind is that when giants fight humans, a lot of times they do tricks that a human would never do. Like they do a bear hug so strong that the protagonist's nose and ears bleed, stuff like that. And one of my big arguments is that pretty obviously wrestling was popular. Sagas come from an oral tradition and they were written and everyone read them, the rich and poor for the most part. So there was kind of reality checks on the wrestling. So we want it to be exciting, but we want it to be real. So if you're gonna fight a giant, the giant can do some crazy stuff. But if you're a human fighting a human, it's almost always in the family and legendary sagas, it's almost always a very realistic depiction of a fight. When you go to the Fornaldur saga or legendary sagas in the past, they get a bit more loose with their descriptions of grappling. And people can get thrown up or get their legs pulled apart. But in the more pseudo historical or historical texts, they keep their wrestling practical and real for the most part.
Okay, so we've kind of spoken a little bit about kind of saga stuff, and what do we know, or do we know what they would have actually, what an ordinary Viking man would have done?
I can tell you with total confidence, a hip throw.
Okay.
They had very good, I mean, like we mentioned earlier, grappling has been very advanced for a long time. You know, MMA is new and we're learning all these. There's someone's creating a zany new jiu-jitsu technique that's, you know, uses multiple inverted rolls and lapel chokes because we have that kind of free time and we train it. But for most of history, wrestling was very important, but like we keep saying, it was very practical.
I think the rules also come into play, because if it's competition wrestling or competition jiu-jitsu where you can't get punched in the face, there's certain moves that you can do that you can't do when there's a fist coming down at you. So I think that definitely plays a part. You know, if this is when it comes to, like you say, fighting for your life or wrestling, grappling for your life, there are certain things you're going to do because the other guy's also trying to hit you in the face, kick you, bite you. So you have to almost keep it very simple, protect yourself and do what damage you can. You're not going
like,
to go
like they say, like they say, a black belt's a blue belt once he gets punched in the face. So
that's it, exactly.
I think it's isn't it? There's a German instructional book on fighting from like the 1400s or something like that, and it basically just like it's got a lot of like moves and it you know it demonstrates a lot of different things, but it basically just goes, go for the balls, man. Just go for the balls.
It's always a good
way to good start.
Solution, I think it's. It definitely is.
Oh, hey, by the way, so, speaking of Germany, sorry, I just have to throw this weird factoid in there. So back in late medieval Germany, you could also, men and women, speaking of men and women fighting, a married couple could settle their disputes in a fight, a legal fight, where the man had to be like buried to his waist. And the woman, I think she could hit him with a sack of like stones or something like that. So he would like stand there and she would like walk around. So wow. That's another way to do it, I guess.
Wow, how progressive.
I guess, yeah.
For sure. For sure, yeah. So Glimmer is obviously known as the Viking martial arts, I guess. Do you think that in the Viking Age they would have trained these moves as like a martial arts, or you know, would have trained, practiced, drilled certain moves for combat, or do you think it was literally just a case of these are innate things and most people who are in a fighting situation just know how to do off the cuff? It's just something
like
you know.
Riding a bike. There's nothing innate about it. You would think that it would be maybe, but there's nothing innate about it. They practiced. They grappled, okay. And they practiced. And one of the traditional uses of Glima, or the one of the common times you'll see it referenced or mentioned in non-saga medieval texts, like Graugas, for example, or law books, you'll see it mentioned. It was clearly done for competition and sport. Now, what they didn't do, we've added to Glima now harnesses and very strict codified rules. And the harness is the modern thing that really stands out. I want to say between 100 and 140 years ago, they started really using it, but I'm not exactly sure on when
right.
The harness first became codified.
Is that the one that looks like the sumo wrestling?
Not really. It's like a belt with two different straps. It looks like
a garter.
Pistol holster / bondage gear.
Yeah. And you give each other wedgies with it, basically.
And you can give each other wedgies. And yeah, and you so there's collar, there's Scottish backhold wrestling. The reality is Glima, like literally every other folk wrestling style, you work with what you have. And rural Icelandic farmers had less than most people on the planet. So they were pretty scarce in their gear.
So the word Glima itself, is that an historically accurate word that comes from the Viking Age?
So the word itself is interesting because, and here's where all of the trouble comes from.
Mm-hmm.
They used, back in the Middle Ages, they used the word Glima. It meant wrestling broadly. Literally, it meant grappling and wrestling. And it also meant a sport of Glima, like a folk wrestling style.
Mm-hmm.
So pretty annoying in terms of researching it, trying to... Okay, where does the folk style end? And it's, you know, I read a description in a saga and they use the term Glima, which means wrestling, but also means a specific folk style. How do I know if this move is the specific folk style or the actual wrestling? And as I've been alluding to, the reality of it is that it was basically just a generic folk style, much like you'll see in modern day back wrestling or Northumberland wrestling, or Turkish wrestling, or even sumo wrestling. I mean, it's all similar moves, similar grips, if they use the grips. If they don't, they go around the back or an under overhook. and they practiced it for sport. But as we alluded to earlier as well, when you practice for sport, you're not tearing out the jugular, you're not slamming their head into the ground, you're not breaking their arms. So they did have a folk style back then called glima that looked at least vaguely like modern sport glima, different move set without the harness, but they did lots of hip throws and lots of inside and outside leg trips. And there's lots of similarities between old glima and modern glima. But my problem comes when, so traditional glima, and I have no problem with sport glima. It is what it is. It's practiced almost exclusively in Iceland. It's cool. It's healthy. It's fun. It's safe. I've done it. It's fun. And this shouldn't come as a surprise, but having grappled all these other styles, when you do glima and grab the grips, I almost don't need to learn anything. I already know all the moves from other wrestling styles. And mm-hmm. So that part kind of bothers me going back into history. Well, this is how the Vikings fought. Yeah, that they fought with these techniques, but was it unique to Vikings? No. So is it, the real debate is it fair to say that a hip throw is Viking?
Yeah.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Just like a hip throw isn't Japanese either. I mean, it's literally primordial. So
let me just throw something in there on the topic of like whether this is Icelandic or Viking or so on. So there's something interesting regarding the word for wrestling in Icelandic. It does not have any cousins in either Scandinavian languages, nor German or Old Saxon or anything. So it looks like the oldest recording of the word is actually in Snorri's Edda, in context of Thor wrestling Ekli, where it is mentioned glima. But it also looked, according to Klisby Vikfursson's dictionary, it also looks like there's a reference to, what is it, glimufélagi or something like that in Hávamál. So in a wrestling match in that poem. And that could place it around, the late 1000s, early 1100s or something like that. So, but it doesn't seem like there are any sources for a similar word in continental Scandinavia, which is quite interesting, because that begs the question: where did the Icelanders come up with this particular word?
Yeah, and from memory, which is not good, the Zoega dictionary and also Klisby Vigfusson, which generally is better, but Zoega, I think, liked grappling, because he has his dictionary is not quite as robust, but he nails it in the grappling section.
Okay.
Very obscure stuff. So I have my theory there. But glima, the term also, in a non-wrestling context, it can be used to mean a flash or a glimmer or something shiny or something pleasant. And so I hear lots of kind of etymological arguments about, they used that because the moves are slick and shy. And, is that a coincidence or is that, I don't know. And the definition of glima is perpetually or forever in the shadows.
Mm.
And so I know almost all there is to know about glima, but I truly believe no one knows why it's actually called that or where the word came from.
Yeah.
But there are a couple theories.
But we know the glima means a wrestling style in the Viking Age. It's kind of what I was mainly getting at.
Not in the Viking Age. Modern word. Not in the Viking Age, but in the medieval period, at least. Like we can't trace it back to, say, 900s, but we can trace it back to the 1100s, 1200s.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, all or most warrior cultures have some form of wrestling. I guess it's a way of getting out frustrations almost, which is what I was going to ask next, was Do you think? I assume that they trained this. This was something that they did. Were they training it or having competitions for battle, or was it for just pure entertainment?
All of it. From source texts, they did it for fun. They did it at fairs, and people did it to show off to the girls. You know, not much has changed in 1,000 years. So, and someone had mentioned in the text earlier, professional wrestling. It was kind of used as professional wrestling as well. The way, if you're familiar with any kind of judo or throwing-based unarmed martial art, when you get the torque and lower center of gravity and the physics down, a small guy can lift a huge guy over his hips and literally float him there and bring him down and make it look like it's a slam, but it's actually gentle. So those kind of throws are great for a crowd, and they're flashy, they show off, and everyone has fun with that. Is that what they did in combat? No. In combat, no one's grabbing the trousers and sidestepping twice to the left and right and then following these rules. Kind of like collegiate wrestling or judo. You practice it in the gym, but if you do it in a real fight, you do a very similar technique, but without any of the bells and whistles. There's lots of gray area here, but it was definitely used both recreationally and in combat.
Okay. So recreationally, do we know the rules that were in place or stipulated of like, this is what you've got to do, this is how you win? I assume it was competitive, unlike pro wrestling, which might upset some people, isn't real. Which is planned out ahead of time, so they know what's going to happen.
You. One cool thing about Glima is that it's very sportsmanship oriented, or at least in the 18th and 19th centuries, they wanted to make sure it was seen that way. So we're talking sport Glima within the last 100, 200 years. So you begin with a grip. You each grab, you know, reciprocal grips on each other's harnesses. And there's kind of a two-step stepping motion that if you Google anyone doing Glima, or honestly any folk wrestling, there's kind of a waltz-like dance to it. And you kind of try to time a throw with the steps of your opponent. That's how you start it. And in terms of rules, you can't let go of the grip unless it's to switch a grip. There's a couple variations. And the big one is you got to get any part of your opponent other than their feet to touch the ground and you can win. There's also variations where you have to bring them down to a knee. That's a little more specific, but the big one is you get the grips and you can do any throw you want as long as no part of your body touches the ground and you get a part of their body other than their feet to touch the ground.
While you guys were talking about this, I just briefly skimmed Anatoly Lieberman's article that actually does reconstruct an etymology for the word Glima and tells us,
all right,
blah 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 blah, boom, the combined evidence of English dialect gleam or glime or something like that, and the reconstructed Icelandic glima yields a verb that can be glossed approximately push or pull aside, cast a sideways look. Basically, that's what Anatoly Lieberman says, and he is the closest thing to a god when it comes to etymology. So
yeah, exactly, and that sounds pretty convincing. I mean, it makes sense. Strangely, I only touched on this in my research because it's kind of a peripheral fact, but it goes with that factoid you just gave. This is sacrilegious. I have a very sneaking suspicion that's actually documented a couple places by myself and others that a lot of Glima and the actual techniques came from Irish slaves or settlers. I'm not gonna contradict Lieberman, but that would fit with his understanding of it. So, I can see some veracity in that for sure.
Yeah. Oh yeah. No, I had a suspicion, man. Thank you for, like, I wasn't going to say anything about, like, maybe it's from Ireland, but I had a suspicion.
Yeah.
Okay. To pull it back to rules, you kind of telling us about that. I was more meaning in a traditional sense. Do we know from, like, saga literature, were they rules that they would have used, the quote unquote Vikings would have used in their sport wrestling?
Yeah. So definitely the big one then, there's no talk about the any part of the body. That's a little too specific. Some of the legal texts actually go into Glima disputes and even talk about, if the guy agreed to do it and you hurt him, it's fair. But if he wants to stop and you hurt him, then you're legally punished. So
that's almost like a submission in.
Yeah. If you keep beating on the guy after the ref stops the fight, you're no longer you're no longer doing a sport. You're attacking a guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they were pretty serious about it. And obviously there were legal problems, you know, there were matches that got heated and the law was brought into account.
Yeah.
Okay. So it was an organized event. It wasn't, you know, it clearly seems to be some sort of spectacle, not just two dudes who decided they wanted to have a little wrestle.
There would be no spectacle if first two dudes didn't decide to wrestle and learn moves first. You know what I mean? So it was both. Obviously, as it got popular, it became a spectacle. And there's guys called Ford the Wrestler, people whose namesake is that they're a good wrestler. So, I mean, it was, in, you know, respective to medieval Iceland, it was wildly popular, or the saga ages, it was wildly popular. But you hear also that shepherds would do it to keep warm. People would do it because they were bored. People would do it for circulation. So it was pretty popular. And like I said, the sport aspect is somewhat gentle. So it wasn't very dangerous. There wasn't any risk in it, which again is why it's not really the way Vikings fought or a Viking martial art. Even if you could attribute these moves specifically or solely to Vikings, which you can't, even then what they did in combat wouldn't really be Glima. Although you could say that it was a technique very similar to one that would be used in Glima. But the number one rule would be you grab and whoever gets brought to a knee first is the loser. That would be the most basic rule.
You have to almost not hurt your opponent, because especially if you're training for combat, you don't want to injure your opponent, because if you have to go to war in a day's time and you're just there breaking each other's arms or concussing each other, then it doesn't benefit anyone because you're just damaging your own people. It's like when you train BJJ, you know, you roll and you're not going 100%. You're not, if you get someone in a knee bar or an ankle lock, you're not trying to actually tear the knee apart, because it's no good for anyone. You get to the point and they submit and you kind of carry on going and everyone's okay.
Yeah, that, of course, you know, there were hotheads back then. And even in some of the sagas, some of the guys are hotheads and the crowd will break it up. And the sagas are good at social insight like this. Can I tell you, from my own knowledge, you know, were the crowds okay with this technique or that? I wouldn't know if the saga author didn't decide to tell us. Not only did this guy do the move, but the crowd did not like it. And that gives us, you know, 800, 1,000 years later, that gives us a pretty good insight into the martial art aspect, where it was about respect. It was about not harming someone who didn't sign up for it.
Because, like, the next level, if you go beyond what is, like, fun and games in that situation, then all of a sudden you have a fucking family feud. Like,
and we know how those turn out.
Exactly. Like, so we don't want that. I mean, it's the same with those instances we have in the sagas where, you know, they're playing ball, some kind of like rugby or whatever that was. And at some point somebody gets so pissed off that he like ends up killing a guy on the other team, you know.
My boy Scott Lagrim. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy.
He loves killing people during ball games.
Right? It's kind of douchey.
Yeah, and there are a couple exceptions, but generally if someone does a berserk move like that in a wrestling match, they are the bad guy.
Yeah.
They're the antagonist. And there's something wrong with them. And even the author lets us know that society wasn't happy about that.
Yeah.
Or even society broke it up and said, no more, no more. And good mention on the feud. A couple wrestling scenes, not many. Normally it's either life or death against evil trolls or whatever, or it's for sport if it's against a human. There are plenty of examples where it's to the death and amongst humans, but the techniques are still standard techniques. They're not particularly vicious until the killing blow. But like you mentioned with Family Feuds, there's a couple times where a heated wrestling match is either the pinnacle of or the catalyst for a feud. And anyone who's watched OG Brazilian black belts at tournaments, they are very serious about pride and honor. So back in the day in Iceland, it could turn into literally a generation-long feud to the death. Especially if you try to win not fairly, or if you try to do something seen as unsportsmanlike, it could be a very ugly next generation or two for your family.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And yeah, no, this is something to keep in mind. The laws would stipulate certain penalties depending on, you know, what kind of injury that you'd cause on another person, right? So that's where this whole voluntary aspect comes in, right? Like if it's at some point shifts to involuntarily situations, then it becomes a matter of crime, basically, and a matter of and that, you know, lacking a police force turns into a feud.
And a nice, interesting aspect of Icelandic society back then was honor was so important that it wasn't just about physical damage. If you inappropriately, and you can see this in their law books, if you humiliated someone unnecessarily or went above and beyond the sport and decided to just embarrass the guy, you can be punished for that because it's very, honor was social currency back then.
Mm-hmm.
So you couldn't clown on someone publicly in front of, you know, their future wife or whatever. That was not smiled upon. That's not really an expression, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I think there's even a feud, a very long standing feud. I can't remember which one that broke out over some guy accidentally hitting another guy in the head with a spoon. Like, it's like, all right, now we go to war.
Now we've got to go. That's it.
Or your horse beat mine in a fight. Now I have to kill your whole family. Like, easy there, guys.
Just sounds like nightmare neighbors next
door.
There
are neighbors from hell in the sagas. They're 100%.
So to summarize, it seems like we just have a very much just a typical standard wrestling culture that you find all over throughout different cultures throughout history. That's got basic moves that are tried and tested over time that we know work, and it's used for sport and also used in combat. So how do we get to 2020? I'm on Facebook and I'm scrolling down and I see this advert or somebody posting in a Facebook group, Gleamer, the Viking martial arts, this is how, train like a Viking, fight like a Viking. And then I click on the video and I watch it and I'm like, no, that wouldn't work. That's not how so fighting this works. Is the thing, like, I still if you don't tried get. That in real life.
Yeah, no, I still don't get, like, how can anybody really believe, like, in this day and age that these Vikings would put on garters and then give each other wedgies? Like, how does that work?
I have, I think, a helpful way to frame the question, which is, do we think that Gauls, how did the Gauls fight, or the Britons or the Saxons, how did they fight? Do we think that they actually fought to the death with Scottish backhold wrestling? No. Who thinks that? Is it possible when their swords got entangled or they had to drop them in close quarters that they did a throw that you could do in backhold wrestling? Of course that's possible and even likely, but do we think that, oh, I want to train to fight like a Saxon, so I'm going to do Scottish backhold wrestling? That's pretty weird. Or like, I want to fight like a samurai, so I'm going to do judo. Well, I mean, that's a pretty bizarre ahistorical disconnect as well.
Yeah.
And all these questions kind of funnel in the same direction, which is, what's trending sells and people are preying on that. I mean, that I think that's the reality of it.
That's it. You do see this very much. This is the Viking martial arts. Learn to fight like a Viking. And it's become that. And it is frustrating to see. And I just wondered if we knew why that happened. I assume you touched on it then. It's a money thing. There's somebody... Or people have realized that they can exploit it and make money from it. So it's now advertised as such.
To avoid specific name dropping, just look at the McDojo phenomenon where, or you can Google, there's a, I should remember his name. I've watched enough of his damn videos. A Chinese, totally mediocre skill level, mediocre physique, mixed martial artist, who goes around China betting all these dojo masters of various traditional Chinese martial arts, like, I'll give you $5,000 if you can beat me up. And a lot of them have agreed. And this totally mediocre MMA fighter mops the floor with every single one of them.
I have seen a couple of those.
Well, so you can see that China is literally, Vikings or wistful yearners of the past, or even more unsavory types, they want a specific Viking heritage, or this is how my ancestors fought, or this is the most badass, whatever their reason for being a sucker, I don't know how else to put it, whatever their reason for buying into someone's made up dojo, you removing it from Glima, you see it in traditional martial arts all the time, and even now in mixed martial arts. But yeah, fat old guys who are saying bizarre things like, I can knock you out without touching you, or if I lift my big toe, you can't knock me out. They have students. They have paying students.
That's where I get a chip on my shoulder with this. And I don't mind, like as I called them earlier, ceremonial martial arts, things like maybe like Aikido, that does have some little bits of work, but for the most part, it is just for show. And people might do it for health, for fitness, and they enjoy it, but it is what it is. And I think you have to advertise it as what it is. It's a ceremonial martial arts, but when it comes to in the street, in a real life fight, people need to understand that some of these techniques just do not work and they won't work. So you might get hurt unless you train in a very much a legit martial arts. And I think people pay money to these courses. And unfortunately, I think it is the case with Glima as well. People pay good money to learn these quote unquote martial arts that they think are going to work in the street in a real fight because they don't know any better. And when in reality, they're putting themselves maybe in more danger because they're going to be confrontational in a fight, but they don't actually have the real techniques to look after themselves. And that's where I get upset about this, because I think it's exploiting people's naivete, but then you're almost risking them putting themselves in a position of danger down the line.
Nothing's worse than seeing the defending from a knife or gun tutorials. Those are like, dude, you're going to get this clown killed.
That's it. You're going to get somebody hurt, and that's what I'm saying about it. Somebody's going to get hurt. Like, just be open and honest about what it is. It is what it is, and it's a nice thing to learn. You keep fit. And I mean, I love karate moves. I like love watching like the, you know, the kicks. It's fascinating. It's really interesting, but it is what it is, and you need to be clear about that.
Yeah, no, this is the thing. So when it comes to the Gleema stuff, there's a little bit of like a history we can trace here. Gleema, as we have already established, is a folk wrestling style that has existed in Iceland for about 1,000 years in one way or another. What happens in the 19th century is, of course, that the Icelanders are pretty damn tired of being part of the Danish kingdom and are in all kinds of ways beefing up their individual culture and identity.
And excellent. I see where you're going, and excellent point. Yeah, yeah. But keep going.
So what is happening, and this also, Thorrablot is another great example of this feast they have in January, where you eat pickled bull's balls, hafra, but what are they called? Sheep, not sheep, the ones with the goats.
Ram. There
you go. Yeah, ram balls and stuff like that. And, you know, you eat all this, like, traditional food that the Vikings will definitely have eaten, right? Even though that sometimes you can't really authenticate that Vikings necessarily ate this, but on the other hand, it's also not like they wouldn't have eaten it, I guess. And the same thing with Gleema, that was part of like beefing up Icelandic identity as something like special and Icelandic that distinguishes Icelanders from Norwegians and Danes and all the other ones, right? And then you have the occurrence of the word in different saga texts. And then, of course, you also have a scholar that's like, well, we have been doing this since the dawn of time, basically. And that's how it becomes Viking, right?
Yeah.
And then, you know, later on, it's a little dormant, right? We have people who are still doing it in the early 20th century and so on. And it's fun and so on. And then at some point, somebody picks up on it, right? Somebody goes, well, this is a nice little niche thing, especially like, you know, in the 80s with the Karate Kid and I don't know what, right? This is a nice little niche thing from a corner of Scandinavia. That we can then use to sort of like build our own
wrap it, sell it.
Exactly, and then sell it. And that's really it, right?
And Vikings have become extremely popular.
Yeah, like calling anything Viking nowadays will sell.
Very much on vogue. Yeah.
Going back about 100 years, there was a Gleema actual wrestler. They used to have much bigger profile competitions in Gleema. And there was a national Gleema champion named Joseph Josephson, and he published he also competed in the Olympics in wrestling and placed. He may have gotten bronze or he may have fifth, but he placed. He did very well in Olympic wrestling, but he was a Gleema guy. And so he, and then a guy named Thorstein Einarsson, who, if you've researched Gleema, you'll run into his name. He was a Gleema instructor and historian. Both of these guys, throughout most of the 1900s, were just constantly trying to get Gleema to be an Olympic sport. They wanted Gleema to be international. Joseph Josephson literally toured the world doing Gleema exhibitions, trying to show people this is our sport. So it became very nationally profound. And I think that's where a lot of the defensiveness comes from. Mm. Like, and trying to identify it, like, this is Icelandic, this is Viking, this is how we fight, this is how they fought.
That's why I don't think there's anything wrong with it being an Icelandic wrestling style. Mm-hmm. And you know, they've got their own little spin on it with the belt,
but to
and
add it's, momentum it's, to make that package sell more, they try to tag on Vikings as well. Mm-hmm. It is currently a very Icelandic grappling, you know, folk grappling style, but my problem comes when you try selling it to people that this is how the Vikings fought and this is how you should defend yourself.
That's it, exactly. I agree. It is, they say, if it's anything like, you know, like collegiate wrestling, it is what it is. It's a wrestling style that comes from, well, certainly with the belts, comes from Iceland. And it's, is it their national sport, or is the Icelandic national sport?
It was their soccer team, their football team did really well a couple of years ago. So I think they kind of sneaked over to football, but
for sure,
until for sure, 2016, it was the national sport.
Yeah. So there's not, I'd like to say there's nothing wrong with that. I have no issue with that, but like you say, it's this is how Vikings fought. And then people who don't know any better listening to that and going, okay, this is a legitimate self-defense. Or, you know, some people, I've had conversations in the Facebook groups, which I regularly frequent, you know, people comparing this to Brazilian jiu-jitsu or, you know, legitimate martial arts, people comparing it. It's like, no, it's fucking not the same. And it's not, and you're going to get hurt.
I have a great story for you. So I trained for 4 years about at Mjolnir, which is the premier mixed MMA gym in Reykjavik in Iceland. It's I'm going to plug them, even though I think they're getting too corporate. The nicest facility. I've literally traveled the world and trained in probably 50 gyms. Nicest facility, like MMA fighting gym I've ever seen in my life. And Gunnar Nelson, who was a very hot name in the UFC a couple years ago.
For sure.
And he's a grappling ace, but has a karate style. So he's a fun fighter to watch. He trained there as well. And they also did weekend Glima classes because they did jiu-jitsu, MMA was what their big things were, but they did Muay Thai and boxing and wrestling. And, I mean, a huge facility, hot yoga, everything. And they also had Glima classes taught by actual MMA fighters who are Icelandic, you know? And I'm going to let you guys guess, do these Icelandic MMA fighters who teach Glima, do you think they used MMA and Muay Thai and Jiu-Jitsu and wrestling when they fought MMA? Or do you think they used their Glima, you know? So, you know, spoiler alert, just that you would have, I did Glima classes and enjoyed it. It's fun. It's cool. But literally fighters who also do Glima don't use Glima. Cause you wouldn't fight like that. And neither would the Vikings.
To be fair, wrestling is also one of the fundamentals when it comes to mixed martial arts. Like legitimate wrestling is arguably the most important thing you need when it comes to a mixed martial arts fight. It can dictate the fight, whether it's standing on the floor. So there's a lot of weight to be put on legitimate, proper wrestling when it's backed up by other aspects.
Yeah, exactly. And not for nothing, but the world has come to terms with wrestling is a shared phenomenon. When someone's a wrestler, the Dagestani wrestlers have a different style than the American wrestlers, but it's all wrestling, and we don't try to pin a nationality or a heritage to wrestling.
That's a really good
so
point.
So to me, it's the whole, yeah, I don't have a dog in the fight. I'm not Scandinavian, and I don't think Glima is very practical. So, but I like it and respect it as a sport, but the need to kind of disingenuously wrap it and sell it and advertise it. And as my supervisor would say, Paul Bowman, he does a lot in martial arts studies, as he would say, is inventing tradition. I don't like that. That's, to me, that's like a con man or a charlatan.
Well, it can easily go there, very easily. You know, I would say that, you know, sometimes I think people also deserve a little, you know, bit of good faith. Like some people actually end up believing something here, and then they'll change their understanding of it later on once they've you know, listened to somebody who knows that they're what they're talking about, like you, for instance.
Hopefully people will listen to this and then and maybe change their opinion.
But I mean, just think about all the myths there are around just karate as a sport, as a fighting style, and so on.
Taekwondo is like 80 years old.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
In lots of people's minds, it's like thousands of years ancient, wise tradition. It's like 80 years old.
Because to us Westerners, it's got a fancy name.
Yeah,
that's why.
And there are plenty of yoga moves that also seem to have been inherited from, you know, calisthenics rather than you know, this distant ancient monks on a mountain and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know? And that's how it goes. There's these ways of working with your body and fighting and so on. They also sometimes, you know, develop and become new things, right? So I think it's this idea. It all goes back to the same fucking problem over and over. People think that just because something is old, then it's somehow better. And it's like, guys, you know how much old shit we've thrown out to get to where we are now.
and the weird, the schizophrenic part of it is that everyone wants the thing they like to be old.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a weird, yeah. The reality is things have been worked on and changed and upgraded and improved upon, and the fat has been trimmed. But at the same time, we still want it to be a 1,000-year-old tradition. Like, no, I would rather have 1,000 years of progress. It's why I love MMA. It's not anyone's martial art. It's all of them. You know why? Because it works. Like I was just saying, it's why Icelanders who train Glima don't use it when they fight people.
Yeah.
You know? Because they've learned, you know, in the last 1,000 years, there have been some pretty useful techniques you can pick up.
But what you're basically saying right now, like now this is trippy. Okay, so what you're basically saying is that we've gotten to a point now where humanity has come together and transcended cultures and ethnicities and so on to kick each other's ass. That's what MMA is. I love it.
The silver lining here is that if you train MMA, you have no, you'll totally kick the Glima guy's ass, you know, no problem. In fact, you'll know all of his moves and 1,000 more. So it's great.
Well, that's the thing with modern MMA is it's constantly changing and adapting, because, you know, you only have to look at modern MMA with the low calf kick, which is something that's coming quite recently.
Yeah.
And it's coming, somebody's picked it up. I think it was Benson Henderson was one of the first ones to use it. And then somebody's gone, yeah, that works. From now on, we're going to implement that and use it going forward. And now it's used by pretty much nearly every fighter in the UFC.
Weirdly, with the calf kick, it was used by lots of Muay Thai guys and lots of non-MMA fighters. But like we talked about at the very, very beginning, that's not a move you practice on your buddies, okay?
No.
You're an asshole if you practice calf kicks on a buddy. So people didn't, it wasn't in their training repertoire. So when they fought, they didn't really, their embodied knowledge or their muscle memory didn't tell them, okay, I should throw a calf kick. And like you said, Benson Henderson, he didn't invent or he didn't use it first. No. He just,
popularized it.
Exactly. He was the one who was like, this move should work really well. I'm going to try it out in fights. And he did. And it worked really well.
So that was something I wanted to ask when it comes back to like the saga literature. And also, I guess, Mateusz, to you with the mythology side of things. Do we see a lot of striking? A lot of like punches, kicks, that kind of side of what would be classed as a martial art?
No.
I don't want to say literally, so I'll say virtually none. I can't think of an example.
Yeah, no, me neither.
There's some pummeling. Mm-hmm. There's the occasional pummeling, but the crowd doesn't like that. Occasionally, a slap, which leads to infinite family feud forever. Slap equals blood feud. I mean, honestly, virtually nothing. I couldn't even write a one-page paper on that.
Thor punches Hemius, as far as I remember, in the story about the fishing expedition where they go fish for the Midgard serpent. I'm pretty sure in Snorri's version of it, the wording is that he punched him on the side of the head or something like that. But that's really it. Like there are very few punches and kicks and stuff like that.
Thor, by the way, Thor was the legit MMA guy medieval Scandinavia. I also remember Thor kicks a dwarf.
Yes, he does kick a dwarf.
I think it's like a drop kick. Like he kicks him out of the scene. Like he literally kicks him.
No, he kicks him into a fire. Like this is like one of the douchiest things that Thor has done. Like he kicks a dwarf into a fire during the burial of Baldur. And it's like,
you think that's offensive? He blocks a giant woman's urethra by throwing a stone at it because she's pissing in a river he wants to cross.
Yeah, that's he doesn't. He's actually kind of an ass, to be honest, in those stories.
In Thor's defense, he's advertised as hot-headed, you know, so...
That's true. Like, it's not like anybody should be surprised here. He came in with, like, I'm an ass. And
all the other gods think he's an ass. Yes. You know, they respect him because he defends them, but yeah. No one ever said he was a cool guy.
No.
No, that's interesting because I think you get this glorifying of Norse gods in modern culture now, especially with Odin. Like, Odin is a massive dickhead. Like, that's
a sodomite, deviant pervert. I mean, he's a skeevy old man, and he's awesome, and he loves poetry, and he's a wizard. But yeah, Odin was, and he's the god of war. He's all these things. But like you're saying, what popular culture thinks of as Odin is definitely not what 1,000 years ago they thought. They were really human with all their shortcomings. The gods, the Norse pantheon are petty and insecure and creepy and perverted.
Rapey, that's the thing.
Rapey, yeah, for lack of a better word, they're definitely rapey.
Yeah.
This all gets forgotten in modern culture when you see people who just, I don't know, talk about the Norse gods and I guess almost pick one as their totem. You see, it seems to be a very popular thing recently. And I say, no, these people, they weren't nice people. They did really, really shitty things.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah, it's not just nice. They weren't ethically good. In fact, they had very little ethics.
That's the whole point, though. Because, you know, now I got to defend it a little bit. Look at the other side of the thing, the coin, right? And like with Christianity, and then notice all the hypocrisy that's happening right there, right? So you could make an argument and say that basically
Odin would make much more sense as a priest.
He would he?
the kind of priest that comedians make fun of.
Yeah. I know. A deity that basically will fuck your shit up. That's the kind of deity that you'll actually have to give sacrifices to. That's how that works, right?
Yeah, this is way out of left field, but that's a good point. If you are the God of the Old Testament is supposed to be fair and omniscient, but everything we read in the text is like and see in the real world. Is like, okay, he's not nice, he doesn't love us, and he's definitely not omniscient or omnipotent, or else why does this kid have a tumor? You know, that kind of stuff. Doesn't make sense. It doesn't add up. But with the Norse gods, you know, speaking from the mind of someone living 1,000 years ago, they're scary. Thor is in charge of, you know, fertility and storms and sailing and thunder. I'm on the sea a lot, and I'm trying to get my wife pregnant. We got to be nice to him because he doesn't play nice. We got to really respect him. That makes sense. Why you would sacrifice to him, why you would pray. I don't know. I like that multifaceted human aspect. The Greek gods had it too. You know, they did it first.
Yeah.
But that
makes more sense as to why people created these people, these gods in the first place, because, or in my opinion anyway, it's because something happens and we didn't know any better, so we put an explanation to it. So there's a storm that ruins your crops, and it's, okay, well, why did that happen? Thor did it. Okay, now I need to be nice to Thor. So it's almost the shit comes first, and you go, okay, well, that must be so-and-so because maybe I did something wrong or I didn't sacrifice. So now in the future, I need to make sure I tick the boxes to keep them happy.
And if you're an Odinic priest or something back in the day or now, and someone's praying to Thor and they love Thor and he's not answering their prayers, but Thor is supposed to be perfect and listen, you've got a lot of answering and explaining to do. If Thor is fickle, well, problem solved. Thor is fickle. And so is Odin. They're all fickle. Yeah.
That's a good one.
I think everybody's a little bit fickle.
Yeah. Well, it's a safe workaround. Yeah. Well, the God, you know, what do we say these days? The Lord worketh in mysterious ways is another way of saying, yeah, who knows?
There's so much ambiguity, isn't there, just to leave it so you can never get a definite answer on stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, or just change it just enough so you can't pin anything down. So yeah, no, this has been fun. I feel like I've learned a lot. So I think to summarize, to pick me up if I'm wrong, I think that we've got a very much just a typical wrestling style that existed in probably Scandinavia and Iceland that the Vikings will have used and practiced for sport and occasionally, I guess, maybe used in combat. That wasn't specific to them, that is now being marketed by modern day for probably monetary gain as a Viking martial arts, but in reality, it's just a wrestling style that
you wouldn't, if someone came up to you and said, I want to defend myself, period, you would never recommend a folk style wrestling system, never, unless you're an idiot. And then if they said, like my ancestors did, and their ancestors happened to be Viking, which already is all sorts of comedy ensues. Well, the Vikings didn't fight. They did this. The Vikings did do this similar form of folk wrestling, but not when they fought. I mean,
okay. How fabulous would that be if when they face off against the Saxons, they all just put the swords down, got into their pants and just fucking wrestled. They just thousands of them just wrestling.
What's it called?
The winner was decided by combat.
Nope. What's it called when two leaders of the army each fight each other? What's that called?
Oh yeah.
I know what you mean. It's like they have a champion.
Yeah, or they have a champion and everyone survives because whoever wins, the loser walks. Maybe they did that with Gleema.
Maybe they did.
That would be brilliant. We've just got history all wrong. No, this has been fun. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you. Very cool. Very cool to talk to people who are game on this topic. And like I said earlier, bridging between academia and martial arts. I love it. That's mm-hmm. what I'm all about. Because too often the two are separate, and an academic, well, like my whole thesis revolves around, an academic with no physical background or grappling experience talking about the wrestling isn't going to know what he's talking about. And a wrestler who doesn't know anything about saga literature or Old Norse or the culture, he's not going to know what he's talking about either. Mm-hmm. So yeah, very cool. I hope you all enjoyed.
I don't want people to think we've just been bashing on Gleema, you know, modern Gleema or this quote unquote Viking martial arts. It's not about that. It's just that if that's what you want to do or you want to practice that and train in that, then all be a winner. I'm not going to tell you what to do. Have fun, knock yourself out, you know, but just understand what it is. And I think that's what it's about. It's just understanding what it is in its own thing, and it can exist as its own thing in its own right, but just know what it is.
Yeah, I don't want to sound like arrogant or a nerd or whatever, but in most facets of my life, and I think most people share this opinion, there's something, I don't want to be tricked. I don't want to be wrong. If I am wrong, I want to learn and not be wrong. I mean, obviously some people want to be brainwashed or whatever, but in general, we want to be right about our stance. And if you find out that it's wrong, I don't want to keep backing up something that I don't intellectually agree with or that I can't make a connection. And so it has nothing to do with is Gleema good or bad. I like Gleema. It's awesome. I like all folk wrestling. I like all grappling. I like most combat other than nut shots and eye gouges. like you're saying, I have nothing wrong with Gleema, but I do have something wrong with people getting something appropriated, misrepresented, and then literally sold to them for profit on a false premise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's not cool.
No.
That's not Viking.
No.
That's true.
No, I agree. And from some of the Gleamer videos I've seen, a lot of it's like rushing in with your head. And I'm like,
not that first, man.
That's not what you do. But, you know, hopefully people will listen to this and we might change a few minds, I guess. Fingers crossed.
Hopefully.
That's it. Perfect. If you got anything you want to shout out, maybe your social medias or anything in general you want to plug?
Yeah, not really. I'm a low key guy with my finger in lots of very uninteresting pies. But my thesis is coming soon, so I'm going to publish that on some of these topics we've been talking about. Some on the academic side, some on the martial arts side. So that's any listeners who like this topic or what we've been or our angle on it would probably like that. Otherwise, I don't know. I do lots of dog rescue stuff. So that's kind of neither here nor there, but be good to your dogs.
I like you even more.
be good to dogs and then we'll all be happier.
Absolutely. We do not deserve dogs. Mateus, what about you? Do you want to do your plugs?
You can just find me on Instagram by my name, Mathias Nordvig. There you go.
you leave all the tough stuff for me. I've made a little list now so I can hit them all. So if you enjoy the podcast, please leave us a 5-star rating and a positive review. Even if you don't listen through iTunes, the best place to leave it is on iTunes. That's where the rankings work, and that's where most people will find us. So that would be brilliant. We recently hit, or at the point of recording this, we were on 92 patrons. When we hit 100, we're going to release our new weekly show where me and Mateus are going to sit down and watch an episode of Vikings each week and let you know what we think. We're going to go through it, let you know what's true, what's not true, what's just absolutely hilarious. You can follow us on Facebook at Nordic Mythology Podcast, Instagram the same, on the website www.nordicmythologypodcast.com. You can pick up a bunch of different t-shirts. We're going to get some new designs on there as well in the near future, and I think that's about it.
All right, I gotta go, guys. I gotta go get vaccinated for COVID. So,
have fun.
Thank you.
See you next week with 3 arms.
Yeah, see you next week.
Glowing green.
I got my large intestine taken out 7 years ago, so this has been like a marathon for me. I gotta go to the bathroom. So good timing.
Awesome. Take care, man.
All right. Good to meet you. See ya.
See you later.